Well, I have canceled my subscription to the New York Times and never had one. Instead, I rely on a far more reliable and leftish LA Times for my news. As you've been told, the title for our panel is Cheerful Conservatives, Please Show Me One. Joyous Libertarians, I Only See Calculating Ones. The Rhetorical Path to Civility. I see a lot of pessimistic conservatives, and I've heard some pessimism today as well. And it's one of my good friends, Peter Schramm, and I have a sort of a long pact. Both of us are immigrants, and both of us think it is our duty not just to give back to America, but to teach the natives what it means to be an American. And that means not to be pessimistic. I ask some of my pessimistic friends in the conservative movement, why don't we just all go down to the Statue of Liberty? By the way, it's not called a Statue of Social Justice. It's called a Statue of Liberty. And maybe the French want America to accept their poor and wretched. But people who come here don't come here simply for social justice. They come here for liberty. And that is something that's very, very important. And I feel like asking my conservative friends, well, why don't we go pessimistic ones? Why don't we go down to the Statue of Liberty and put up a sign that said, immigrants not welcome? Not because we don't want you, but we're trying to save you from America. And I just think that's rather alarming. And so I think in a certain sense that we ought to, one of the important questions that we ought to be asking is, if conservatism is conserving pessimism, why be a conservative? Why not conserve optimism? And there are many optimistic moments, and one of the most, seems to me, incredibly optimistic moments is provided by a rather uncivil conservative, Wilmore Candle, who suggests that Americans are conservative in their hips. And to me, that means that to the extent that Americans go center-left or even leftish, the voting public, the public that really matters, it must be some rare occasion that puts it that way. I mean, pushes that way. It's not natural. There must be something that's happening. And so one has to recognize those moments and figure out why is it? And as was just been mentioned, I see one of those very important moments as the New Deal. We're in 1932. In 1934, they had a chance to sort of reflect on it, and nope. Thank you, please keep going. 1936, another chance, nope, keep going. So 1938 was one of the first chances. So that, and then it starts to return to a debate. So there's a certain sense in which that is a rare moment. Now, I wouldn't say that Obamacare is settled in any way permanently yet, because it hasn't gone through that process by means of which the American people have come to accept it. And just to say that it was passed is not good enough, and to rely on the courts to try to settle these things is not good enough for me anyway, in terms of what it means to be a constitutional conservative. I've seen libertarians, but they tend to be calculating, and from marriage to virtually everything else. And while I have a lot of libertarian friends, I wonder about how far to take that in terms of, and I have libertarian inclinations myself. But I just don't know how far to take that. Civility, as far as I'm concerned, is out unless we just want to say yes, sir. I think the real path, that rhetorical path to take is, why do we, what's your matter? You getting some what? You want me to step back from the mic? Is that better? I will be civil. What? Put the mic up? Too high? Too low? Just right? I like middle of the road. My real challenge is not the question of civility as much as it is liberty. Why does liberty have to keep being defended? One of my good friends, Nick Capaldi, asked that question at the Liberty Fund conference. And the answer, I think, is because liberty is not the central attraction in the modern world. I think the central attraction is security and equality, which means the case for liberty has to be made in each generation. It is not the default position. And so one of the reasons why I am inclined these days towards features of libertarianism is because I think it's making one of the best current cases for liberty. And so I want to say it's, I think there are better cases to be made, but I think it's one of the best that's going right now. What I'd rather talk about, based on that, is Luddite liberals and insufferable progressives. And what I'm trying to suggest is that we've heard enough today to of both humor and seriousness, but I want to try a slightly different path to see whether we can open up, even at this late hour, a slightly different conversation. We've heard a lot about the fusion, Frank Meyer fusion, between your traditionalists and your libertarians, and we've even heard conservative constitutionalists suggest that, well, the libertarians need to have an acceptance, and the acceptance is they have to accept the New Deal. And that's it, which means, in other words, that we cannot really open those questions anymore. Move on. I'm not quite prepared to accept that the New Deal is completely here, even though it has a very solid beginning, and maybe at least the conservative position has to be to restrain the extent of the New Deal. But I think that is a revolutionary moment within America. So it becomes very, very difficult simply accept the premise that the future of conservatism cannot really revisit the New Deal. That's a tough one to accept. The other one that seems to be the message in terms of this fusion is that traditional conservatives have to accept the arrival of the sexual revolution. If I have to make a choice, I'd rather see bare hips than bulging budgets and increasing deficits. But I, once again, it seems to me that that's a tough one simply to accept. So I think that the future of conservatism in part rests on what conservatives are willing to accept and what are they willing to fight for within this fusion. And I think the possible hope is that there is a confusion within the left. And that confusion is that there are two wings, not necessarily easily identifiable because they've sort of come together in a very nice way, between what we might call the libertarian, for purposes of just putting this thing together, sort of the open society, more libertarian progressive, who is very interested in free speech, turning free speech into free expression, the kind of thing that Wilmore Kendall and others and Russell Kirk really were concerned about the direction of America in terms of false freedom, the freedom without responsibility problem. But I also think that we have this, what I've called insufferable progressivism, which is more closely linked to a sort of a closed society conservatism, the kind of society which says we have to have an orthodoxy, so that if there is a fusion within the conservative movement, I think there is also a confusion within the left. And just to repeat it, there is a libertarian left, which is a perverse libertarianism, not the kind of libertarianism that I would support, but there is also this orthodoxy, and the confusion is clearly in the LA Times. And part of its confusion is that it would love the open society, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, not only because of its own self-interest, but because it sees the role of the newspaper as exposing the whether it's the robber barons or the dirty capitalists or the filthy rich or whatever. And they're also very, very sensitive to affirmative action, the marginalized, the progressive part. But a beautiful story was in the LA Times the other day. And the beautiful story is that they objected to speech codes and trigger material that has been passed at Oberlin College and that has been considered by the students at UC Santa Barbara, and it's growing on all college campuses, and anybody who's been on a college campus understands that that kind of creeping orthodoxy is very much there, whether it's coming from the outside imposing through the accreditation agencies, rather insufferable people who have very little idea about what education is about, probably coming from departments of education, which means they have failed academics. Or you've got people who are internal, who are so concerned with not coming on the front page, so therefore they turn the whole institution over to lawyers and accountants, which means, in other words, that the information technology wants you to change your password every 3 days. And our students don't see that as a problem because freedom and the digital world go together and it's not a problem. Like a grumpy old conservative like me who is still optimistic, I see that as a real difficulty. The idea that university, like, we're all employees. The idea of being a professor doesn't seem to matter anymore. We have to pass what WASC says or what the other people say. Why? Because we'll lose our credential. Credential for what? What are we teaching? The reason why I love the School of Public Policy is it's because it's rebellious. Can you be conservative and rebellious? The answer is you better be. In other words, what I'm trying to suggest is it's not civility and conservatism that should go together, but rebelliousness and conservatism that should go together, because there is now a progressive orthodoxy. It's coming. If Oberlin has said, and U.S. students at Santa Barbara are contemplating that courses offered by professors in their syllabus should have a trigger mechanism. And the trigger mechanisms would include any films that are going to be given, any lectures, any outside, any exams, which, listen to the operative language, which might offend, produce the moral equivalent of traumatized behavior in the minds of, now I see that's not the John Stuart Mill Open Society, LA Times, let's have a free-for-all competition idea. That is orthodoxy. And so that the universities are being altered to conform to the standard is anything you say, anything you write, anything you do that might offend ought to be self-censored. Because that's the role of the new university. It's feelings. It's about suffering. It's about the forgotten. And if we want to trace this back, you can trace it back to, in part, the FDR and the debate with Hoover. That is a clash in terms of, it seems to me, the rugged individual, by which Hoover did not mean the narrow, selfish, mere calculating individual, but the frontier person who took care of himself and his family, and women worked and supported the family as they went across the frontier. The rugged individual has been debased as some kind of selfish in animal. And instead, what we should be focusing on is on the forgotten man. And that becomes so that when I look across the land and I see one-third unemployed, one-third such and such, one-third such and such, that's what I should be concentrating on. Well, I mean, what about the 70% or 80% who are pretty well off? Thank you very much. They worked hard. They were immigrants. They came here. They did things. What about them? We are redefining democracy from a mechanistic sort of counting mechanism of 80% to a universal creed, and that is everyone. Once the forgotten man, the marginalized person, the creed turns to universal, not a majority, as long as there is one child left behind, however dumb, as long as one child left behind, we have failed. As long as there's one fat person left behind, we shall not stop. And part, Peter and I have this other sort of question that we go, how conservatives should ask the question, why have progressives been so prevalent? That is, the founders have been around for 225 years, depending on where we start counting. The progressives have been around for 125 years plus. That's a long time. Now, I don't think they've been completely successful. I think FDR, they were successful, but they've been successful in our schools. And you can see it. And one reason, I'll give you three reasons for what I think the progressives have been successful, other than the usual conspiratorial arguments and that kind of stuff, which I'm not really interested in. One way in which the progressives have been successful is that they have made at least a partially successful effort at detaching every single American generation over the last 100 years from the founding. That is, I don't see how the young can love something that is presented as ugly. But you mentioned the websites. And I was foolishly pleased to hear from a parent who said, could I have a conversation with you? I said, sure. She said that you have presented the Christie painting in which these 55 delegates, except what, 39 signers are in there and they're talking and this is this beautiful painting and teachers love it because they can use the visual, not just the textual. And I said, that's great. That's wonderful that you do that. He said, yes, but the teacher focused on the issue of what's wrong with this painting. And the answer is, they're all white, they're all male, they're all, and they didn't even mention that there were two Catholics. They didn't mention that there were seven immigrants. You have to start somewhere. Apparently, they got very upset because there were no transgender. They've been successful from Charles Beard, 1913 on. It has been a fight. One has to fight to preserve the American founding because that is basically the alternative, it seems to me. The second way in which the education has worked is that ideas don't really matter. It is the consequences that create the ideas, not the ideas that create the consequences. And so therefore, it's not the word, it's not the Constitution that matters. It's something else that's behind it that matters. That's a second, that's kind of appealing. A third reason, my final reason, is that somehow the progressives understand something. And that is, if conservatives need to understand that they cannot undo the New Deal and they have to accept the sexual revolution, which I've said I have difficulty with, but let's say that's for the point of argument. I am going to suggest that the progressives have to accept two things that ain't going away in America: God and guns. But they've been so successful in one way, that is, because Americans believe in God, Americans are susceptible to the idea of a moral crusade. And the way in which the progressives have been successful, in part, has been to present issues as the moral equivalent of slavery. So how can you get possibly the Progressive Amendment, 16, 17, 18, and 19? What the heck has the 18th Amendment got to do with progressivism by banning alcohol? The answer is because this orthodox progressivism is, they're actually abolitionists. They are prohibitionists. No child left behind, no drunk left untouched. We are here to clean up the mess. And there is something within the American spirit that responds to the idea that there's something more important in life than simply me. There is a bigger issue involved. That is why JFK's statement, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, seems so appealing to Americans, and yet to some of us more libertarians, looks rather odd. But it's service to others. And once you present politics as a war on drugs, a war on poverty, a war on such and such, sign me up, I'm patriotic. So the progressives have not simply accomplished their objectives by underhanded means. They have accomplished their objective by rhetorical means, by appealing to certain features of the American people that are susceptible to that kind of talk, and they've done it by constitutional means, 16, 17, 18, 19th Amendment. The New Deal does not have any amendments, all interpretation. There's only one amendment. We shall not have a president for more than two terms. Thank you.